That's Maceo Parker, yes. Maceo Parker of James Brown funk band fame with Horace Silver's Sister Sadie. It's from his 1991 album, Mo Roots. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and Sister Sadie is in tribute to one of the cast of characters that would be appearing in our discussion today. We return to the trail that we have been following with respect to the Clinton Foundation, and there are significant developments going on. And of course, we can't talk about the Clinton Foundation without talking to Charles Ortel, who has devoted more than 2 years doing nothing but looking at documents and following facts and numbers and coming up with the conclusion, as he did back in 2007-2008 on Wall Street, when he put forward the proof that the crash was due in large measure to companies, major corporations, overvaluing their stock by hundreds of billions of dollars. So he has been looking at the Clintons. We've been talking about the Clintons for a long time, and we've been talking about the foundation and coursing you through the back end of it, where people are just not going until now, when they see how complicated it is that the foundation, the correctly called the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, is really at the epicenter of a syndicate, if you will, of highly irregular financial activities. We talked about that in great detail, and we will continue to talk about that. Where we left off was Senator Grassley, Chuck Grassley, who is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, asking, in fact, demanding the opening of a probe now. This is more definitive than it has been so far. He clearly is in possession of some information that is quite disturbing, and he wants not just one, it seems, he wants several probes initiated into the Clinton Foundation and its several affiliates, and outside of that, many of the activities engaged in by Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, and associates that do not pass the smell test. At the same time, we have several governments who had donated hundreds of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation, demanding an accounting of where the money went. And so we pick up from the Grassley request for a probe. Hello, Charles, and welcome.
Thank you, Therese. A pleasure to be back on with you.
Look, we've been talking a lot about the Clintons, and is it your feeling that things are beginning to tighten up and the initial thought that we had that this is not something that should go unpunished, this is something that requires a really deep look?
Yes, and thanks, Eutrice, for giving me a chance to share with your listeners what I've been looking at now for, I guess, 2.5 years. When I set out on this mission, I did it in part because I really value what people do across the political spectrum in charities, and I think that our large and vibrant charity sector is something that does make, indeed, the United States of America exceptional. It's something we all could be proud of. And so when I saw this presidential foundation, or this fake presidential foundation, getting away with the type of behavior that so besmirches not only all the contributors and all the executives and all the trustees involved and all the professionals, but it gives a bad name to charities around the world, and it calls into question other charities, some of which may actually be doing good work. So I decided that this was, as we discussed before, that I hate the phrase, but I think this could be and may well now become a true teachable moment, an example that can be used so that people who get involved, particularly with U.S. charities operating internationally, don't operate them the way the Clintons have operated this fraud. And it's obviously taken some time. It was accepted wisdom up until whatever the date was last November, when Donald Trump actually won. It was accepted wisdom that Hillary Clinton would be the President of the United States. Indeed, I think we should join and wish Sister Hillary a happy birthday. I believe today is her birthday, because I saw an article talking about how she ill-advisedly tweeted out birthday wishes to the next President of the United States. That's one of those tweets you really wish you could undelete, I think. But most people, and indeed many of the people I did approach, particularly those internationally, said to me, listen, Bob, we love you and your work's fantastic, but we really do not want to be on the wrong side of the Clintons when Hillary becomes President of the United States. So thank you very much. We're just going to, you know, wait. Well, those people, many of them have now had a chance to see that Donald Trump, he has obviously many faults, all humans do. But I think many of the never-Trumpers, whether the Democrats or the Republicans, refused to believe that he'd won after he'd won, thought they could maybe get a recount by, thought they could get him, stop the inauguration, then thought they could use this dossier, the Russian dossier, against Trump and push him out. And, you know, despite all their efforts, despite all the people who all the time bombs and landmines that were laid as President Obama's team left, and despite the fact that actually there still remain many Republicans who do not like Trump, Donald Trump seems to have prevailed. And the other thing that's happened with the passage of time, people have begun to understand that it really doesn't make sense to give money to the Clintons in the vain hope that someday Chelsea Clinton will be anything other than one of the world's leading experts on this or that disease. I mean, she has no political instincts, worse than her mother, in my view. So why would you send large amounts of money towards the Clintons when they are never going to again hold any significant political influence? So I think when the penny began to drop on that, and then most recently, when it emerged, that it appears that the lawyer whose law firm was responsible for spending, it looks as if some estimates are as much as $9 million on this Trump debt dossier, and we can get back to that one. I have no idea why anybody would pay $9 million for any kind of report, unless it was a report on how you could magically extend your life, you know, without signing up for some expensive regimen of pills. I mean, it's $9 million for a report is a lot of money. I think we need to ask some very tough questions about that. But when it emerged that this particular person, Mark Elias, E-L-I-A-S, at the firm Perkins Coie, C-O-I-E, in fact, was working on behalf of the Democratic National Committee and on behalf of the Hillary Clinton campaign, and that they had spent $9 million on this report, having for a year denied, not just to you and me and the listeners, but to the vaunted gray lady, the Maggie Haberman at the New York Times, Kenneth Vogel at the New York Times. When the Times learned that, I think that changed things a lot, because the real message of this whole story of the whole Clinton years, as we begin to really think without the blinders on about what happened, is that they duped us. They duped many, many people. And many, many contributors were taken advantage of here. And now as this starts to unravel, and I do think, Chuck Grassley is a man of principle. He's, I think, almost 84 years old, longtime senator. You know, he's been tried and tested in many different complex matters. He's taken very seriously by across political spectrum. He behaves honorably, professionally, quickly, and can apply tremendous resources, as he is doing here. What has surfaced since the last time we talked is that a a confidential informant apparently had come forward who knows all about what was happening here, has records, has recordings, has paperwork, has notes, is a person of standing, and he is now going to be able to testify about matters that I think some matters are classified, so they're going to have to be kept internal for processing time anyway, about a saga that begins sometime in 2009. Now, why is this very dangerous for the Clintons? To date, the way they've been able to distract everybody is to have us focus on the period 2010 forward, right? And to say, you know, if you go back before 2010, that's ancient history, who cares about it, you know? Well, in fact, 2008 and 9 are very significant periods. The real mammoth fraud, and there was fraud before it, but the mammoth fraud begins on March 31st, 2008, when the Commonwealth of Massachusetts revoked the authority for the largest piece of the Clinton Foundation by far to operate. That was the HIV-AIDS piece. So, and then that was big trouble, because in March of 2008, Hillary was clinging to hope that she might indeed be the presidential nominee. She was fighting tooth and nail. So they hired a lawyer named Kamiki Gibson. That you get from the Podesta WikiLeaks dumps. You can see her report, her 19-page report, which says on November 10th, 2008, all this is publicly available. You can see Kamiki Gibson basically, if you understand charity rules and the Clinton record, he's basically delivering a death sentence to Bruce Lindsay, the CEO, in writing, saying that basically the Clinton Foundation is boldly out of compliance with many laws. There's this lawsuit. There's an admission, and I think that memo, that the head of the biggest piece, the piece that had its authority revoked, confessed to diverting $23 million from restricted accounts that had then disappeared. This is while the election's still going on, while McCain has a chance. That confession occurred in July of 2008. So, there's a horrible record here. And what is particularly galling is that Kamiki Gibson's memo is dated on November 10th. Precisely 6 days before Valerie Jarrett signs the supposed agreement, the Memorandum of Understanding, in theory regulating the conflicts between the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. So you have a record, you have a confidential informant that then gets you into 2009, where there are problem after problem after problem in 2009 that get worse and worse and worse. And would have led a serious accounting firm, the firm that signed, or the person at BKD who actually signed the audit for the Clinton Foundation concerning year 2007 that was finished in 2008, year 2008 that was finished in 2009, and so on. That person needs to go to jail, because that the audit is so far out of compliance. You know, an auditor is not supposed to just say, well, all right, you know, we'll just, whatever you want, you trace, you got it. You know, for a charity, you actually have, if you get paid money to perform an audit, you need to check the rules that apply to the given charity. Now, this charity was operating all over the world. It was soliciting inside New York State. It was soliciting inside California. That's obvious. You can see it in the public record. And when you do that, you need to prepare books of account that are done on what is called a consolidated basis that considers all of your operations around the world. It's strictly required. And you have to consider, you know, the basic issue that if you're a charity and in order to survive, what you're doing is you're offering donors the ability to take a tax deduction, well, you better damn well make sure that you're actually in compliance with federal law, and more important, that you have applied and are in good standing in all the states where these potential donors, like New York State and California, do have rules where you have to qualify also for state tax exemption and file valid state forms. You better check all that. And if there's a possibility that you've reorganized the foundation in a way by creating this Clinton Health Access Initiative during 2009 and this Clinton Global Initiative during 2009, that where you've made fraudulent statements to the IRS, which are a matter of public record. Anybody who understands the law can see that in their forms 1023, which are on file in New York State for the Clinton Global Initiative, and for, well, they're on the Clinton website for the Clinton Global Initiative, and for the Health Access Initiative, they're on the New York State website, you can see that the application is riddled with lies, yet Lois Lerner approved it. So the existence of a confidential informant with standing and notes and evidence who now is being debriefed and soon will be talking to Chuck Grassley and then most likely other members of Congress, possibly the IRS and other places, the existence of that person opens a can of worms. I would use a different phrase, but I don't want to curse. Whoop is the first part of it. It places the trustees now with this looming tax deadline of the 15th of November to file and complete their 2016 forms. It places the trustees, and in particular their professional advisors, in a vice, because the rules are very strict. If you're fundraising, you better make sure, and they are actively fundraising, you try to go on their site and they make you get through a donation query exercise in order to get to the underlying information for certain things right now. They're actively soliciting as documents remain false and materially misleading. They're doing so across state and international lines. They are doing so certainly using digital media, likely using phones, likely using wires. This is mail fraud, wire fraud, solicitation fraud. You're sitting there. You have an ironclad obligation as this various foundations, the main one and all the satellites. Many of them have a calendar year end, which means that their final filings are due on the 15th. And you don't have to get them on solicitation fraud. You don't have to get knowing solicitation fraud. If they're soliciting, if their filings are false and materially misleading, and if a government, state, federal, or foreign wants to make an issue of it, you're done. As Corinne Brown discovered, it's just a question of do these governments have the interest in doing anything? And where before, right through the election, you know, Democrats had hitched their cart really to the wrong horse, it seems, in retrospect. But they weren't going to do anything to enhance the ability of Donald Trump to win. And it's taken time for them to get, you know, along in their grieving. But now we're many months in. Donald Trump is finding his feet, it would seem. And, you know, this really is a horrible case. This is a case of a former president and an aspiring president, a lot of crooks, frankly, around this mess, thinking that it would make sense to contribute money and support this mess, because if Hillary gets into the White House, you know, they'd have her under a gun. They'd always be able to trot this out, so they'd be able to get, you know, favors out of her in terms of perhaps no bid contracts or whatever. And if they had any brushes with the law or any possibility that any part of their, you know, their various enterprises might, you know, want to find the favor of the federal government, well, they'd have a willing accomplice in the White House, and she might be in there for 8 years. So, yeah, I mean, there is a record here. This is not, you know, this is actually an easier case to prove than the public corruption aspects of it, which are the focus of the Uranium One deal. Charity fraud is very simple to prove. You don't, you know, when you bribe a public official, I don't believe there's a contract, a formal contract of, you know, I'll give, you know, Utrecht will give Charles Rochelle $10 million in Switzerland, and in return I'll give you, I don't know, some contract to run Obamacare. You don't write up a contract like that when you bribe somebody. So it's tougher to prove bribery. But in the case of charity fraud, you absolutely have to file public records, and they exist, and they're fraudulent, meaning they're false and materially misleading. They omit crucial information, which if a donor had known that information, they certainly should not have made a contribution. I'll give you an example. In the case of the actual main function of this foundation, it's supposed to be a complex in Little Rock housing our records, not Bill Clinton's records, our records, the American public's records of the assorted eight years where Bill and Hillary Clinton were living in the White House. And Bill was, in theory, running the executive branch. Those records are the property of the people of the United States. And the Presidential Libraries Act is a mechanism passed in 1955 and amended in 1986 to allow private contributors to erect the complexes that might house these records. They're not a vehicle and may not be used as a vehicle to ensure that only Clintonistas are the ones who get to review the 8 years of his work as for all of us as President of the United States. That is not the intent of the law. That's not the way the law should be administered. That's not the way the law, I think, will in future be administered. But the Clintons believe and the Obamas believe that that's how you get away with running a presidential library. And so to make sure that this thing had a possibility of being lawful, an agreement, a crucial agreement called a joint use and operating agreement, which is purposefully withheld from the Clinton Foundation website but available through the National Archives. I and others have the official copies, or copies of the official copies. And they categorically require, for the life of the existence of this presidential complex in Little Rock, they require it to be run as what's called a publicly supported charity, or to be technical, a 509A1 vehicle. That means it must have independence. It must have independent trustees. It can't be a place that's only controlled by people who love the Clintons or by the Clintons themselves. Not allowed to do that. So it secured authority from the IRS, and it was required to represent to us via the National Archives, we the people, that it was in fact a public charity on November 18th, 2004, the date this thing was commissioned. In fact, on that day, the Clinton Foundation was a fraud. They had, beginning on March 24th, 2004, they illegally created a subsidiary called the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS Initiative in Arkansas. Prior to then, in Ireland and other countries, they had been soliciting in 2003 to fight HIV/AIDS when they had no authority to do that. They collected a small amount of money from Ireland, about 1 million euros at the tail end of 2003. I have copies of the cables from the Irish government minuting the plaintiff requests from the Clinton Foundation for money and minuting the wiring of 1 million euros to the Clinton Foundation for fighting HIV/AIDS relief in 2003, when it absolutely had no authority to do that. They then went ahead in 2000. They formed a subsidiary legally in Arkansas. They form subsidiaries illegally in South Africa, India, certain other countries. They do not have the authority to do that. They illegally raised money, including from the parent foundation, and put it into this fraud. They may have filed an application with the IRS to get federal tax exemption for this fraud, but there's no evidence. The application is missing. There's no proof that such an entity was ever given tax authority. All this was happening right before November 18th, 2004, on the very day that the president of the Clinton Foundation signed a binding, long-lived agreement, almost a 100-year agreement, that was a pack of lies. And this person went on from that post to subsequently become the second dean of the Clinton School of Public Service. And that says a lot right there. So, the record here is a record of fraud from the inception. And now we have the eyes of the world, thanks to you, Yatrice, and your listeners, your patience and interest, the eyes of the world have been turning on this. Initially, when I would reach out to representatives of different governments, they'd say, well, Charles, if you're right, how come your own government is doing anything about it? Well, the tenor of those conversations changed dramatically as it became apparent that indeed the IRS had been looking at it. And later, as it became apparent that FBI offices may have been looking at it, but that the New York Times, among others, had decided explicitly not to report that real news, but instead to report a whole bunch of fake news. When it became apparent more recently in our conversation after our interview and with what Grassley was doing, that Chuck Grassley, and he's not just, he's not Jeff Flake or Bob Corker. I mean, Chuck Grassley is a serious hombre who's been around the Senate for a long time, has a lot of resources, has smart people on his staff. When it became apparent that he was going to bird dog this thing and he was going to demand a special prosecutor be appointed, all things changed. And now we have...
But Charles, this is an interesting point, too, because now we have what my father used to call a curious concatenation of events. You have a bunch of things coming together here, and now it looks as if they're trying to prioritize, which comes first. Do you go after the Clinton Foundation first? Do you go after the Uranium One? Do you go after the election issue where Hillary, the Clintons, I should say, sought to derail the election? You know, how do you, because there's so much fleshed out with the Clinton Foundation, and now it has become a global matter. You have all these foreign governments now demanding to know where, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars, where did they go? With Grassley, and you're seeing already a resistance, it's all nice and very Southern, but Jeff Sessions is in no hurry, it seems, to start with the foundation, which is where I suspect Grassley wants to start. So how do you assure the order of investigations, or is it one of those things that everything has to be done at the same time?
Well, actually, it's we're in a very happy place, whether by design or accident, we're in a happy place, and that is that the foundation absolutely must file by November 15th, 2017, a complete and truthful report concerning 2016. If the trustees allow the executives to file a false and materially misleading set of forms under these circumstances, the trustees will be eating a gigantic personal tax liability. Of that, I'm quite sure, which could include penalties, interest, and depending on whether they're reckless or not, whether they refuse to get engaged and understand the facts, might even subject trustees of the Clinton Foundation to jail time. So this isn't, you know, a time where you can say, I'll get on my boat, you know, going around the world cruise. No, you've got to stick your noses in, and you can't delegate this to some junior punk. You know, if you're a billionaire or the wife of a billionaire, and you're on the board of the Clinton Foundation, any one of its entities, and you don't understand.
You're referring to the wife of Bill Gates, I'm sure.
No, I'm actually referring to the wife of Haim Saban, Cheryl Saban, who is Haim is originally born in Israel, I think, but he's a very successful investor in, I think, media and entertainment, and a big backer of all things Clinton and many Democratic projects. He himself operates multiple foundations, as does his wife. So they have no excuse. They can't say, well, we don't understand how foundations work. Okay? A lot of questions have been raised, not just by me, but by many others, some predating my interest in this. And, you know, they have to file this report by November 15th. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but it's just been announced that John Koskinen will be replaced imminently, if not like right now, before his term is up on November 12th, I understand. Or maybe it's just on November 12th. I read the release very quickly off my Twitter feed. I'll check it after we get off air. But John Koskinen is out. A new person who comes from the outside, I forget his name exactly, but I saw that he was, before he was got a Treasury appointment in August, U.S. Treasury appointment, he had been, I think, with Ernst & Young for a long career as an accountant. So this is a person who understands accounting and will be well able to come in from the outside. And one of the first things he needs to do is fire the acting person or the person in charge of the tax-exempt organization and then ideally get some outsiders to take a real close look at that entire department, soup to nuts. The people who actually review the applications, the people who do the audits, all the decisions, I would argue, going back probably to 1992, if not earlier, the major decisions involving major foundations and charities need to be looked at very closely. Now, is there any good news in all this? Not for the people who've been enabling these charity frauds. Some of these people, many of these people, I hope will go to prison. And I think the test we should all use is, you know, if Corinne Brown gets off light, then, you know, maybe I'll be in a mood to be more lenient. But if Corinne Brown is made an example of over an $800,000 slush fund operating for a number of years, you know, then the people who are around these big slush funds contributing to them, thinking them, and maybe many getting favors, they need to go to prison. and taxes need to be assessed. And the good news for Donald Trump, and actually for Congress trying to work it, and for the American public, frankly, who needs some tax relief, tax fairness, the good news is that there's a pile of assets sitting in charities. It's about $5 trillion in total sitting there. Some of it is run very responsibly, but much too much of it is not run responsibly. Too much of it is used as it shouldn't be used. You're not allowed to use a charity for partisan political purposes. Too much money is used that way. Too much money is stolen, particularly money that's used, as the Clintons seem to have used it, internationally with no controls. So on $5 trillion of assets, assuming there isn't a stock market crash, that would, let's say, drop it to 2.5. Well, let's assume there is a crash and it drops to 2.5 trillion, drops 50%. Okay, that's a pretty conservative assumption. You know, if 10% of these charities are run as the Clintons are, then rough numbers, you're looking at maybe getting back $250 billion in a one-time move against subjecting these big charities. And I would say, you know, I would start with the biggest. The Harvards, the Yales, these places that, you know, you're supposed to be engaged as a charity furthering only your tax-exempt purposes. You're not supposed to be set up as a, you know, to become a gigantic hedge fund, a private equity fund, where your professors on the side become multimillionaires and deign to teach students, you know, the odd class here and there when they aren't making paid speeches or writing books. You know, these big universities have turned into a place. And I went to two of them, and I have great affection for those that I attended. Nonetheless, you know, these universities are the places that, you know, that when there's a crisis in the for-profit land, they're the first to attack, you know, these crooked corporations. Well, what if some of these big universities have lost their way since 1989 in this globalist period? What if instead of actually focusing on educating students, in particular American students, because after all, they get a gigantic benefit from the American government, the American taxpayer. If instead they've become, you know, apostles of globalism, proselytizing globalism because it benefits all of them, and they're also making a lot of money, that strikes me that, you know, that's a dangerous place to be. If, you know, you're operating a presidential foundation, as the Clintons have done, you know, if you begin it, it's kind of the simpleton's guide to thinking about fraud. You start the project as private citizens, at least Bill is a private citizen, January 21st, 2001. On that date, you're bankrupt. 16 years later, you're worth $250 million. What is wrong with that picture?
Well, we see it developing, too, in Chicago with Barack Obama's foundation. Exactly. It's following the same model as the Clintons.
Exactly. And you know, this is, you know, I know in the, throughout the world, frankly, you know, in certain regulated industries where there are unions, particularly in the public sector, there's this approach that, you know, at the end of the number of years you need, whether it's 20 or 30 or 40, you know, if you're a good player, you can retire with, you know, setting your exit year pay at a higher level by getting a lot of overtime and double time and triple time and all that kind of stuff. You know, that's not the way the presidency should be viewed. It shouldn't be that, you know, you're going to get some sucker in there who's actually going to, you know, do the bidding of the richest people inside and outside this country. And if the sucker plays along with the game, the sucker gets thrown a bone. You know,
I want to ask a question about some legal issues we may or may not have an answer for yet. But part of the criminal or allegedly criminal acts that occurred at the Clinton Foundation involved, of course, her role as Secretary of State and Bill Clinton's office as President of the United States. And I'm referring now specifically to Haiti.
Right.
Now, Bill Clinton was designated to pilot the rebuilding of Haiti after the 2010 storm. Billions of dollars are not accounted for. The project essentially utterly failed. And there is no rebuilding. There has been no rebuilding of Haiti. And yet, a lot of money has just disappeared. To what degree is Bill Clinton liable, not only as President of the United States at the time and Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State at the time, but also as the principals of the foundation that kind of put its resources together with other funds, commingled other funds, to say, well, we coming in strong on this project and we're well capitalized. How does the court or the legal process manage something like this, so complicated, where you have a head of state and secretary of state of one country performing with the blessing of the United Nations and other international groups, taking the lead on a project like this? And by the way, I might add, the first thing that Bill Clinton did was to get the Prime Minister of Jamaica thrown out of the project. He was the one that the Caribbean states had nominated to take charge of this process as part of the Caribbean community. Bill Clinton saw to it that he was gone. PJ Patterson. So, right. To your mind, how is this going to work?
All right. So, stressing that I'm not a lawyer, but I think I understand some of the rules here. We would need to turn to our analysis, I think, to jurisdictions. So, under New York law and under federal law, the Clintons, because they live in New York and because this foundation has been operating basically directed from New York and is subject to New York law, the Clintons, just for their violations in the core foundation and its affiliates, face, in my view, enormous, staggering financial exposure and legal exposure, just for that, before you get to Haiti. Now, what the Clintons and the UN have done, in theory, is concoct a fanciful world where people who are designated as special UN envoys, of which Bill is one of those people, can argue that they are immune with respect to that activity from U.S. National and other junior laws, state and local laws inside the U.S. You can argue with respect to the Haiti thing, maybe you're immune because you're a special U.N. envoy. But there is a quirk in that law. And first of all, international law is not really finely developed yet. There are lots of vagaries and question marks over international law. But under the law that applies to the UN, the President of the United States has the right to say, you don't get the immunity with respect to this activity from a U.S. perspective because we see something you didn't tell us before. So in the case of the UN, it is a simplistic way of thinking about it. So with regard to Haiti, Haiti seems to be a nation that cannot help itself and certainly cannot protect itself from people like the Clintons and others who are quite prepared to go to Haiti in its time of turmoil, not just in 2010, but earlier as well, and to basically monetize the suffering of others, find those rail thin, children with the beautiful deep eyes and slap them on the cover of a fundraising appeal. Next thing you know, the grandmothers and grandfathers around the world are sending you $10 billion, and it disappears time and again. And it doesn't just happen in Haiti. It happens across Africa. Sadly, it seems to happen primarily involving children of color, dark-skinned children and people. These people like the Clintons and others, it's really embarrassing, frankly, if you look across the covers of their various annual reports. And nothing changes. And we raise a hue and cry about it, and everyone says, isn't this horrible? And, people are normally quick to say those Republicans are doing awful stuff. And I don't even think we need to get into whether it's a partisan issue. The record the Clintons have in Haiti alone is so diabolically bad. And the record of the various and sundry plunderers affiliated with Haiti. I mean, in 2010 alone, you mentioned the big appeal, which was sort of outside the ambit of the Clinton Foundation. There were two separate appeals. Bill put together something called the Clinton Foundation 80 Fund. There was no such legal paperwork. It never was organized properly. But nonetheless, the instant the hurricane earthquake hit, I think on the 12th, he was raising money. No one really knows how much money he raised. In addition, prior to that, the State Department and Hillary and the friends of the, Hillary's people, had put together a deal for this crook, who's now in federal prison, I believe, Osorio, to get our government to overpay the cruddy homes that, the money never actually ended up, and the homes never actually ended up in Haiti. And this guy's in prison because he stole the money and used it on fancy living and yachts and cocaine and other things. That was the small beer stuff. Then during 2010, Barack Obama and Michelle, for some reason, were seduced into supporting this thing. They sent $200,000, I believe, by wire out of his Nobel Peace Prize winning portion. That's a matter of public record. And he supported this fraud. He was defrauded. Whether he was defrauded knowingly or not is another question, but nonetheless, he was defrauded. The biggest piece here is that the largest transfer out of the Clinton Foundation in 2010, a fact that is evidenced in their 2010 initial return filed in November of 2011, and their amended return for 2010 filed on the 16th of November 2015, shows $37.2 million wired from the main Clinton Foundation, so using a wire, into a post office box, into a place in Baltimore, Maryland, where there was no such office. And this is in the forms. It's sitting right in front of our faces. Who was the attorney, U.S. attorney in Baltimore at that time? Rod Rosenstein. Rod Rosenstein is the same person who, in my judgment, did not prosecute Ranbaxy aggressively enough for their diabolical activities, sending adulterated drugs around the world, HIV/AIDS drugs, to the poorest places on earth. Rod Rosenstein is the same person who apparently may not have prosecuted this Russian collusion exercise that is just the subject of Grassley's latest attention involving Uranium One. He's the same attorney on that. He's everywhere in the same place. Why isn't Congress asking some very tough questions about how it is that the Clinton Foundation, its various entities, Uranium One, the insider trading involving Rajat Gupta, the Ranbaxy exercise. There are lots of things here where, yes, people were tagged with fines and maybe short prison terms, but not to the extent they could have been. And they all seem to involve Bob Mueller, James Comey, Rod Rosenstein, Loretta Lynch later on, Eric Holder. And, you have always been asking, how much did Barack Obama know about it? The most explosive thing that has come out in the last 24 hours that I've heard is the lawyer for this confidential informant claimed this morning on a radio broadcast that I listened to carefully because I know these people. They're very good. She says that the confidential informant has proof that President Obama himself was aware of this Russian corruption exercise that began in 2009. He was aware of it in the presidential daily brief. What else was he aware of? How much did he know about the Clinton Foundation fraud? How much did he know about the likelihood that U.S. government tax money was used to purchase adulterated HIV/AIDS drugs and shipped around the world? How much did he know about that? How much did his team know about that? These are big questions. And, why does it take so long for Congress to do what's right here? I mean, these aren't subtle questions. When you operate a charity, you're supposed to be a presidential library in Little Rock, Arkansas. How come nobody asks the question, why are we spending tens of millions of dollars traveling around? The great Mark Stein, who is, I think you may know him, Stein, who is, I believe, originally, I think, Australian or Canadian, maybe English, but he noted in a hilarious appearance with Tucker Carlson that the British royal family spends $7 million a year on travel. How could the Clinton Foundation spend tens of millions of dollars a year on travel, operating something that's supposed to be a presidential library in Arkansas? Are the fares to Arkansas that expensive? I mean, the answer is that they were using this as a slush fund, just as Corinne Brown was using it. but a slush fund to entertain the Clintons in an imperial lifestyle. And that's a model that Barack Obama may think that he should copy, and that would be a very big mistake.
Well, we heading toward the close of the program, and I wanted to ask, with this confidential informant coming forward, what do you expect the next steps will be in this Clinton Foundation story?
Well, it's a gigantic record. I'll give some advice to the Clinton Foundation trustees, they should immediately cease fundraising and appoint a conservator. That's the first thing they should do for all of their affiliates. Stop fundraising, appoint a conservator, beg for mercy. That's what they should do. What they will do is another question. And advice to the prosecutors and the investigators, do not strike any bargain with the Clintons, because the history of the Clintons at this is always to hide the key information for as long as possible and get you to negotiate with them on a basis where you don't know as much as they know about the truth of the situation. No point in doing that. The statute of limitations has lots of time to run here, I'm told, and no need to rush into anything. But for the benefit of the public, this foundation needs to stop raising money immediately. It is breaking the law every second that it raises money. It is damaging the public trust. It is damaging the integrity of the justice system. It needs to stop yesterday.
Well, Charles, it's certainly exciting knowing you and your hermit life. Your hermit life is paying off. I want to remind the audience that Charles Ortel single-handedly turned around the crookedness of Wall Street. And just with a pen and a pad, and I don't know if you even used a calculator.
I did.
But when you zero in on something that is absolutely wrong and out of kilter, you invest in the investigation of the issue. And I understand that many people in high places are now understanding the importance of this issue only because you invested so heavily in producing evidence to back up your contention that this is the largest unprosecuted fraud in U.S. history. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Trace. My pleasure.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of the program. And I want to say, not to pat ourselves on the back, but the information that you have gotten and have been getting about the Clinton Foundation exclusively here, the idea is to give you as much information as possible, and it's not available anyplace else. And that's what we do. We try to bring you information that is credible and that helps you to understand things a little bit better, to show you the various dimensions of an issue so that you're not swayed by the, McJournalism. McJournalism is you get a story done and that's the end of that. So we take our time. We've been doing the story now for 2 years and following it in a way that practically nobody else in the journalistic world has. Well, there are a couple of people. We've had them on as well, but not to the extent that Charles Ortel has. And so we are very lucky to have him make himself available to us to get to understand this problem. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories, LEID, stories, plural, at gmail.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. Help us promote this program and promote this station. And we'll see each other tomorrow for Free Your Mind Friday. Bye-bye.